morning, everybody. Good to see all of you here this morning. I'd like to ask you to go ahead and open your Bibles to Psalm 126. And we'll be studying this psalm during our time, at least in the Bible class this morning. As you're turning there, I just want to, let you know how much I appreciate the invitation to be here. This is, I think, my second time to be in Omaha. And I'll just tell you really quickly about the first time I came. The only other time I've been in Omaha, I was actually on my way back from Lincoln. And I was stopping in Omaha to meet a friend of mine for coffee. And I didn't really know where I was going. She was trying to give me directions over the phone. And then I ended up getting lost and taking a couple wrong turns. And as I was trying to get there, it had been raining that day, and I came up on a stoplight. And I hit my brakes kind of suddenly and locked them up and ended up skidding into the rear bumper of the car in front of me. So the only other time I've been in Omaha, I got a ticket for following somebody too closely. But I'm confident of better things this week. So I'm looking forward to the week with all of you. We're going to be talking about what I believe are some of the most important things for us as Christians to be talking about and thinking about this week. We're going to be talking a lot about our influence, and specifically how influence relates to our ability to be evangelistic. Because if we're going to try to be the kind of people that God wants us to be in relationship to the lost and to trying to reach those who need the gospel, our influence is one of the most critical things to that. So, and there's the thing that we're going to be talking about this morning in Psalm 126 is really the foundation for all of that. It's where evangelism and it's where influence starts. And if we don't understand some of the concepts that we're going to talk about this morning, then we'll never really be able to be the kind of influences that we should be or that we want to be. So, Psalm 126. I want to go ahead and just read this through. And by the way, what we're going to do is, since this is normally Bible class time and used to discussion and everything, I'm going to try to do a little bit of that. And actually, before we read this, I wanted to start with a question and just ask you guys. When you're thinking about, I mean, just in your own life, how evangelistic you are, or how effective you are trying to talk to people about the Bible or about spiritual things, what do you think are some of the reasons that that's difficult? I mean, what are some of the things that make that a challenge for us? What are some things that are the most difficult about it for you? What do you guys think about that? Let's just take a few minutes to talk about that. And feel free to whoever wants to comment. Yes.
Well, I've been Christian for about 17 years now. And in the beginning, it was very difficult for me because I just had fear of the unknown and fear, you know, that I didn't know enough, and I didn't know how that person was going to respond. But I was so enthusiastic because I learned the power of God in my life, and so I just, you know, couldn't help but say things to people to get people talking. And eventually, I got over that. I got over that fear, and now it's a whole lot easier. Even if people don't like what I have to say, it doesn't bother me. It bothers them.
Good. And I think that's probably one of the most common is we're afraid of, and it can be different kinds of fear. It can be we're afraid of somebody asking us a question that we don't know the answer to, or we're afraid of forgetting some passage that we want to talk about, or we're afraid of what people are going to think of us. Maybe we're afraid of our reputation. It can be different things. Okay, good. Other thoughts about that? What are some other things that are challenging about
this? Yes, I think it can work in the opposite direction, too, because if you ask somebody to study the Bible with you, and they say yes, you go, I got to do this.
Good.
And it's a challenge, and some people are a little leery about going after the challenge.
Good. Yeah, sometimes we're, you're right, it is kind of funny, but we're afraid of success. I mean, we're just afraid of not being prepared to handle that stuff. So, good. Yes, sir.
I think in between is also the fear of responsibility. Okay. You know, on a personal level, I'm responsible for my own salvation. If I take the initiative to bring somebody else to Christ, I'm responsible for what I teach them.
Good.
And what if I get something wrong?
Good. Very good. All right, anything else? Any other thoughts about that? Okay. I think those are all good things, and really there are a lot of reasons that we're not as evangelistic as we'd probably like to be. But what we're going to talk about in Psalm 126 is really going to get at the heart of that. So let's just go ahead and read it together. I'm going to be reading from the New American Standard Version. So yours may be a little bit different depending on the translation. But Psalm 126 is a song of ascents. Verse 1 says, "When the Lord brought back the captive ones of Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with joyful shouting. Then they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. The Lord has done great things for us. We are glad. Restore our captivity, O Lord, as the streams in the south. Those who sow in tears shall reap with joyful shouting. He who goes to and fro weeping, carrying his bag of seed, shall indeed come again with a shout of joy, bringing his sheaves with him." Now, I think there are a lot of really great things here. What we're going to try to do, first of all, is just look at the context in which this psalm was written. And you notice right off the bat in verse 1, it says, "When the Lord brought back the captive ones of Zion." There's our context. There's the historical setting. So let me just ask you guys another question. What does that sound like to you? I mean, what's going on here? What's the setting of this psalm, or at least what are your ideas about that? When were some times that Israel had been captive or had been brought out of captivity? Yes, yeah.
It would be from the Babylonian captivity.
Good. So this immediately we see here, and a lot of times we think of the Psalms as, you know, things that David wrote, and so we set them in that context. But a lot of the Psalms are written, of course, by people other than David in times other than the time in which David lived, and this is one of those. So immediately we find the setting here is the people who are writing this are people who had been brought back from captivity in Babylon. Now, there are a couple ways to talk about this. I'll just mention this really briefly because I know some people think like this. If you're an outline person, I'm just going to give a really brief outline of this psalm, and maybe that'll help you, I guess, in your mind. But in verses 1 and 2, it's kind of a four-part outline. Verses 1 and 2, we have a preamble, sort of the setting of this psalm and getting that all straight. Verse 3 is praise that's given to God for what he has done. In verse 4, we read a prayer on behalf or on the part of the writers directed at God. And in verses 5 and 6, we see a promise that God makes, or we see how this relates to promises that God makes to his people. So, verse 1, "When the Lord brought back the captive ones of Zion, we were like those who dream." What does this person mean by that? I mean, when he's talking about, it's like we were in a dream. I want you to just try to put yourselves in the shoes of these captives who were the first to come back from Babylon. I mean, if you were a Jew living in Judah at this time, what's just happened in your world is that the place where you lived and you always knew that God lived for hundreds and even thousands of years has been destroyed. And your confidence in your God and in his power and in his might over other kingdoms of men, I mean, that's going to shake you significantly, I think. So you're forced to leave that land where you always knew that God was powerful and God dwelled and acted. And you have to go thousands of miles away to this foreign nation. The culture is different. The language is different. The customs are different. Everything's different. Imagine what that would feel like. I mean, if you had to leave your home here in La Vista or Papillion or Omaha or wherever you live, if you just had to pick up and leave like that, and you were taken to a country where this was the case, different customs, different language, how do you think you might be feeling about that? I mean, certainly there'd be some fear there. Certainly, maybe there'd be some anger at this whole thing. How can they do this to us? Maybe you'd be angry at God or bitter about this. But whatever those feelings are, that's what these people had to deal with. And so 70 years later, Cyrus issues a decree, and they're allowed to go back. Now, if you were one of that group, imagine what that would have been like. Because the thing is, most of the people who would have been able to go back to Jerusalem probably had never seen it before by this time. I mean, most of the people that were young enough to have remembered it and seen it growing up were probably dead by the time the 70 years were over. So if you're one of the Jews that goes back, and maybe you're one of the few who's old enough to see it and you remember it, maybe not, maybe you just heard stories about it. But can you imagine, you travel up the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, and then you turn and you go south down to Jerusalem. And as you're approaching it, maybe you see it off in the distance. Can you imagine what that must have been like for these people? I mean, here's this place that you've heard about so many times. I mean, you've heard stories about how great the temple was, and all of these buildings in Jerusalem that were significant, or all of these altars or monuments or whatever it is. And then you're finally there. You actually see it. Kind of get the feeling it would be like they were in a dream, wouldn't it? I mean, this is almost too good to be true. This is, we must be dreaming. Sometimes we think like that when we finally get to go places that we've always wanted to go, and we've heard great things about. Like, I didn't get to go to Disney World until I was, I think, almost out of high school. But I'd heard about it, so when I finally got to go there, it was kind of like a dream in some way. But we think like that sometimes. So what we see here in verse 1 is they finally get back, and it's like those who were in a dream. And what we see in verse 2 is that there's a cause and effect here. Notice the way that each of these verses begin. When this happened, then this happened. So the cause was God brought us back from captivity. The effect was then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with joyful shouting. Now, that seems kind of interesting at first. It might seem strike you as kind of an odd reaction. Why would they be laughing about this? But I want to just remind you about another story in the scriptures that I think helps us illustrate this. Go back to Abraham's life. Remember, when God promised, before Abraham was Abraham, back when he was Abram, God promised that he would give him a son. And God made that promise a long time before Isaac was ever born. And so for all these years, Abraham kept waiting and waiting on God, and he even tried to come up with his own way of fulfilling this promise. He tried to have a child with Hagar, and that's where we get the story of Ishmael. But that wasn't God's plan, and so God keeps telling him, I'm going to give you a son, I'm going to give you a son. And finally, when he's 99 years old, God comes to him and he says, okay, this time next year, your wife, Sarah, is going to be pregnant with a son. And you remember what Abraham's reaction to that was? He laughed. Because this was such an amazing thing that he could hardly believe it. The only thing, really appropriate reaction, was to laugh about it. He was just out of sheer joy at this. In fact, we read a little bit later on that Sarah laughed too, maybe for different reasons. But I think that's what's going on here. You have something that's so unlikely or so remarkable happen to you, and you just kind of have to sit back and say, wow, you know, you laugh about this. And that's these people, that's the Jews. They get back to Jerusalem, their mouths were filled with laughter and their tongues were filled with joyful shouting. Now, notice what else happens here. Because we notice that Israel's celebration didn't stop with them. It actually had an effect on the people that were watching them, the foreign nations that were watching them. At the end of verse 2, it says, then they said among the nations, the Lord has done great things for them. I think that's key for us to understand that God bringing Israel out of captivity wasn't just for Israel. Now, it was to fulfill promises that he had made way back when to the forefathers and all of that. But it also accomplished a very important purpose. And that was that it made a statement about God to all of the other nations that were around Judah. Now, think about why that would have been important. Because, okay, say that you're a Babylonian, or say that you're an Egyptian, or an Assyrian, or whatever foreign peoples were around Israel. And they keep talking about this great God of theirs, Jehovah, and how mighty he is, and how powerful he is, and how good he is. But then his own people get taken into captivity for 70 years. Their entire nation, their capital city, is basically wiped off the map. It's made into a ruin. What do you think kind of message that might send to these foreign peoples? Well, obviously their God can't be that great. I mean, he's not powerful enough to deliver his own people. It seems that the Babylonian gods, Marduk and Ishtar and all of these, are stronger than Jehovah. And this is God's answer to that. So he brings his people back and restores them. Now, how did people know that that was the case? I mean, how did they know that this was God who was responsible and not just the benevolence of Cyrus? Well, notice verse 3, I think, gives us our answer. Not only did the nations say the Lord has done great things for them, but verse 3 says the Lord has done great things for us. We are glad. I think this implies that the Jews understood very clearly that this was God's doing. And the implication there, I believe, is that they talked about it. So how did the other nations know that Jehovah was behind this? Because the Jews talked about it. They made it very clear to everybody else that he was the one who deserved the credit for this restoration of theirs. Now, we look at this and we think about how remarkable this is in the historical context. But here's the great thing about this psalm. This psalm doesn't just apply to Israel. It applies to everyone who's ever been brought out of captivity by God. Now, how many of you have ever been in captivity? Some might hear that question and say, well, we're Americans. I mean, we kicked the Redcoats out 200 years ago, and we haven't looked back since. But I want to remind you, or get you to remember something that Paul said about this in Romans chapter 6. Remember, he said something like, the one to whom you give yourself as, the one to whom you serve obediently, you are that one's slave. And in the context, he's talking about either being slaves of Satan and slaves of sin, or slaves of righteousness. The truth is, whether we realize this or not, there has been a time in each of our lives that we've been in captivity. And that may be a weird thing for me to say. I realize that I don't know most of you very well at all. But I'm confident of that. That in each of our lives, there's been a point at which we've been in captivity. Maybe it's still true of us. But for some of us at least, there also came a time where God took us out of that captivity and brought us to life. And so here's the application for us. Everything that was true of Israel in this psalm is also true in some ways of us. Think about this. When the Lord brought back the captive, let's read over this again and think about how it's true in your life. When the Lord brought back the captive ones in Zion, we were like those who dream. Then our mouth was filled with laughter and our tongue with joyful shouting. I want you to think about when you first became a Christian, or you first realized your need for God. You started to see the sin in your life and how bad it was, and you realized that I need to give my life to God. I need to obey Him. I need to do something about this. And so you did. You turned away from that old life of sin. You were baptized, and you had those sins washed away. And God delivered. He led you out of captivity. Do you remember what that felt like? I mean, can you see how for us that's really like a dream come true? I mean, how could anybody do? I mean, when you think about how awful we were, and the fact that God took us from death to life, He took the stain of sin off of our souls. He took us out of that blackness. He made us alive again. That's too good to be true. Who can do that? And so that leaves us with this reaction. We don't know what to do except to laugh and to rejoice and to praise God. Now, again, just as with Israel, there was another purpose behind that, and the same is true of us. God didn't deliver us just to deliver us. Now, don't miss the point that was part of it. He wanted us to live. He wanted us to have forgiveness. But there's something more to that, and we're actually going to talk about this a little bit more tonight. But just as God was making a statement to all of the nations around Judah when he delivered them. When he delivers us, it makes a statement as well to everybody that doubts him. When they see God and they think, well, he can't really be that powerful, can he? He can't really be that great. Our lives are supposed to be the demonstration of that to everybody that doubts it. Now, that's a pretty phenomenal thing. I mean, to be taken from the lowest of the low, the depths of despair, and given hope. In fact, I want to just spend a couple minutes looking at another psalm that I think illustrates just how remarkable of a thing this was in Israel's life or in the life of the Jews. Psalm 137, please turn over there and let's just read the first four verses of this psalm. Psalm 137 is really the before picture. 126 is after they get back from captivity. 137 is what they're writing when they get to Babylon. Verse 1 says, "By the rivers of Babylon, there we sat down and wept when we remembered Zion. There we hung up our lyres on the poplar trees, for our captors there asked us for songs, and our tormentors for rejoicing. Sing us one of the songs of Zion. How can we sing the Lord's song on foreign soil?" You see what their reaction was, or you see how they were behaving here? They got to Zion, and they were so distressed at this, the only thing they could do was just sit down and weep. They didn't want to play music. They didn't want to sing songs. This was awful. In fact, you notice what the Babylonians did. Sometimes they taught them. They'd say, hey, sing us one of the songs about your God Jehovah. We want to hear one of those. Because we think that's really cute. I mean, you sing about him, and you guys seem to really love him, but he doesn't seem to be that strong. But sing one for us anyway. Can you imagine how humiliating that must have been for them? And I think we can understand why their reaction was simply, we don't want to do anything. We just, all we can do is sit down on the banks and hang up our harps and our lyres and just cry. There's a historical side of this that I think is impressive too. The historian Arnold Toynbee wrote that there has never in all of human history, there has never been a nation that's been fully taken captive and then later on allowed to return and rebuild the nation that was once there, except for Judah. In all of human history, this is the only time that's ever happened. In fact, if you're a Jew and you're considering this, you think about, how little hope they must have had. They had just seen their northern neighbors, Israel, taken into Assyrian captivity, and they were never the same. Can you imagine what that must have been like for them, from going from that extreme to the exact opposite and being able to return? That's the case with us. But so much of the time, we forget that we were that bad off. I mean, we don't see how extreme we were, how bad things were. Over time, we can grow complacent and get so used to grace that we forget that we were captives to sin. We had no hope. Nobody was going to be able to deliver us at all. And then along came God, and he delivered us from captivity. We've got to remember that, just for our own faith, but also if we're ever going to be evangelistic, that's where it starts, is that recognition. Now let's look at the second part of this. He goes on, he says, "Restore our captivity, O Lord, as the streams in the south." Well, what does that mean? That seems kind of an odd thing to say. Is he saying, okay, you brought us out of captivity, now we want you to restore it and take us back to captivity? Well, that doesn't make any sense. Does anybody have a different translation of that in their Bibles, a different reading of that?
Mine says, "Turn again our captivity."
Okay, turn again our captivity.
Okay. Mine says, "Restore our fortunes."
Okay, restore our fortunes. Some other versions also say, "Return our captives." And I think that kind of clarifies it the most. What's going on here is that this is a prayer on behalf of, or on the part of those who had come back to Jerusalem, for those who were still back in Babylon. Now again, go back to their shoes. You get to Jerusalem, you walk in, you walk into the city, it's in ruins, but you're in Jerusalem. I mean, just imagine the joy, the laughter and the joyful shouting, all of that. But you notice what they do they get back there and they remember, despite all of their joy, that we're not the only ones. That we still have brothers and sisters and fathers and mothers that are back in Babylon captivity. And so what they do is they pray to God and they say, restore these captives. Don't leave them there in Babylon. Bring them out as well. And then he says, as the streams of the south, or yours may say, as the streams of the Negev. This is the imagery of the southern part of Israel, a desert area, where during the rainy season, most of the year it was completely dry. But during the rainy season, all of the rains that kind of came from the mountains would all come down into the desert, and they'd flood these riverbeds or these creek beds, and they'd just overflow and they'd be gushing. And when that happened, the southern region of the Negev just came to life. I mean, you'd be able to grow stuff there. You'd have things coming alive that were dead all year round. And that's the imagery. Restore these people captives. Bring life to a dead place. The streams in the south brought imagery of relief and refreshment and revival and all of these things. And so this is a group of people that get back to Jerusalem, and as excited as they are about God delivering them, they still remember that there are those who haven't yet been delivered. Now, can you start to see how that applies to us as well? I mean, God brought us out of sin, to be sure, and He delivered us from certain death. He took us from blackness to light. He took us from being aliens to being reconciled to Him. He took us from all of that to what we have now. But the truth is, there's still people that haven't been delivered, right? I mean, there's a whole group of people that are still captive to Satan. And maybe those are brothers and sisters. Maybe those are mothers and fathers or sons and daughters. But maybe it's just our neighbor down the street. But the point is, God's not finished doing His work until everybody's out of captivity. And we've got to remember that. here's one of the things, another one of the lessons that we learn here. Our blessings have never been intended to just stop with us so that we pat ourselves on the back and say, hey, look at what God's done for us. Our blessings are intended to remind us of those who don't have that. God gives us these blessings with the hopes that we will be reminded of those who are still in captivity, and then pray for them and try to use what God's given us to bring them out of captivity. Now, he goes on in verses 5 and 6, and he says, those who sow in tears shall reap with joyful shouting. He who goes to and fro weeping, carrying his bag of seed, shall indeed come again with a shout of joy, bringing his sheaves with him. Well, what's that all about? How does that fit with this, with the context of this? Is he talking about perhaps those who have been restored back to Jerusalem coming back and now they get to Jerusalem and their task is to rebuild the city? I mean, they go back to building their homes and planting their gardens and sowing their seed there. Perhaps the idea is as they sow this seed, they remember what things used to be like. And they remember that they still have family that's captive in Babylon, so that even though they're sowing and starting their lives again, they're sowing in tears because they know not everybody's there. Maybe that's part of it. But I think there's a little bit more to that, more to this than just that. And I want to take you over to the book of Jeremiah to see something that I think helps us make sense of this. Go over to Jeremiah chapter 29. Jeremiah 29. We're going to read a few verses from this chapter. And Jeremiah 29 is interesting because it's a letter that Jeremiah writes to the captives in Babylon. Remember that for the most part, Jeremiah during the captivity, or at least during his life after the captivity, stays in Jerusalem. Eventually he's taken into Egypt, and it's likely that that's where he dies. But for a long time, at least, after the captives are taken, he stays in Jerusalem. And he writes this letter telling them what to do. Now, again, put yourself in the shoes of the captives. You get to Babylon. What do you do? Well, Psalm 137, we just sit down and we start crying because we don't want to be here. So maybe that's your reaction. I just want to curl up in a ball and die. I don't want to be here. Or maybe your reaction is, well, we'll just wait because Because God will fix this, right? I mean, maybe there were still a lot of faithful people who believed that God would turn around and just and punish the Babylonians and bring them right back. I mean, yeah, we've learned our lesson, God, now deliver us. But look at what Jeremiah tells these exiles in Jeremiah 29, verse 4. He says, "This is what the Lord of hosts, the God of Israel, says to all the exiles I deported from Jerusalem to Babylon. Build houses and live in them. Plant gardens and eat their produce. Take wives and have sons and daughters. Take wives for your sons and give your daughters to men in marriage, so that they may bear sons and daughters. Multiply there, do not decrease. Seek the welfare of the city I have deported you to. Pray to the Lord on its behalf, for when it has prosperity, you will prosper." You notice what God's telling him to do there. He says, don't just go over there and curl up in a ball and not do anything, or don't go over there and just be so depressed that you just squander everything. Go over there and live your life. You plant your gardens, you build your houses, you keep marrying and having children, and live your normal life. And what God says is, when you do that, that's actually how I'm going to bless you. Seek the welfare of the city. Try to look out for Babylon's interest and try to preserve it, because that's the way that you're going to be delivered. And so I think that's part of what's going on here. They would have been over in Babylon, and Jeremiah tells them, okay, I want you to plant your gardens. I want you to go ahead and sow and keep living your life. Now, if you're one of those Babylonian captives and you go outside and you start to plant your garden, and you remember Jerusalem, and you remember your vineyards there, and the orchards there, and the gardens there, you think it would have been hard not to just break down and cry? When you think about what you had and the fact that it's all gone now. I mean, I don't know how we really relate to that, but I think that's the idea of sowing in tears. But the promise was, if you do that, you keep living your life, you'll reap in joyful shouting. Notice what God goes on to say in verse 10 of Jeremiah 29. "For this is what the Lord says, when 70 years for Babylon are complete, I will attend to you and will confirm my promise concerning you to restore you to this place. For I know the plans I have for you, declares the Lord. Plans for your welfare, not for disaster, to give you a future and a hope. You will call to me and come and pray to me, and I will listen to you. You will seek me and find me when you search for me with all your heart. I will be found by you, declares the Lord, and I will restore your fortunes and gather you from all the nations and places where I banished you, declares the Lord. I will restore to you the place, or I will restore you to the place I deported you from." So God says, you keep sowing. Sow in tears. But the promise is, there's going to come a day when I'm going to bring you back. I'm going to take you back out of Babylon, and you're going to get to go back to Jerusalem, and you're going to get to have all of those things back. Those who sow in tears will reap with joyful shouting. Now, for the last few minutes, let's try to see how this applies to us. Because the sowing for the captives might have represented building their homes and living their lives there and planting their vineyards and all of that. What do you think that kind of, what do you think that concept represents for us? What does sowing mean to us? What do you guys think about that? Any ideas?
Bearing fruit for an eternal reward.
Okay. Okay. And the Bible talks about that in different ways. When it talks about fruit, I mean, most often we think of it in terms of winning people's souls over to God for the Lord. And we think of that kind of sowing. I mean, the parable of the sower. But it's interesting, the Bible also talks about the fruit of the Spirit, things like character. Part of the sowing that we do is getting rid of sin in our own lives. Now, I want you to just think about all of those concepts of sowing and what that means. Sometimes we sow the seed in the sense that we try to reach the lost. Sometimes the sowing that we do is getting rid of bad behaviors and bad habits and sinful things in our lives. Sometimes it's trying to work on relationships with people that aren't Christians, trying to help them grow. But by the way, I just want to make this point really quickly. So the prayer in verse 4 is restore the captives. You notice how God does that? Verses 5 and 6 are the answer. God restores captives, or he brings people out of captivity through the sowing of the word. Now, I was just thinking about this and how it applies maybe to our lives. I was thinking about how it applied to me growing up to my parents. Because the thing is, you know, we talk about all of these things. We talk about sowing in tears and reaping with joyful shouting. And the thing is, people want the same, I mean, pretty universally, people want the same things in their lives. They want good relationships, and they want godly kids, and they want good marriages and things like that. I think here's the point of that. That takes work, doesn't it? We have to sow in order to reap. And so often, so much of the time, we expect God to give us all of these blessings without putting in the work that it takes to do that. I think about my parents and the times when, you know, like they were trying to raise me and my brothers. I know there were times that they sowed in tears. I know that there were times that they were just beside themselves about what to do. They were trying to raise these kids right, and they just keep doing dumb things, and we don't know what to do about that. I know that there were times that my parents cried over my brothers and I. But you see what happens there? You put in the work, you sow in the tears, and the promise is you reap with joyful shouting. Yes?
Well, I was going to say, I think, too, we remember who this was written to at the time. It was an agricultural society. I think we lose that so much today, being, you know, a bunch of city slickers, for lack of a better word. We don't really understand how much effort goes into sowing and how much patience you have between the time that the sowing takes place and the time you're going to see results. We're a very instant gratification society.
Good point. And you know, what's interesting about this is we look at a statement like that. So God says if you sow, the blessings will come, or you'll reap in joyful shouting. But I love what he does in verse 6, because sometimes, okay, we say, okay, well, God promises rewards to those who sow. But you notice verse 6, he makes it personal. He goes from those who sow in tears to he who goes to and fro. And I think the point there is that sowing it happens on an individual level. It's got to start with me. And if it doesn't start in each one of our lives, then we're never going to be able to accomplish what God wants us to accomplish. Now, some of the difficulty about that is sometimes we look at our lives and we think, well, I'm just one person. How can I have any kind of good effect? And maybe you're thinking about your life. I've got all these friends that I want to reach, and I feel like I'm the only one that's trying to stand apart from that. How can I make any difference? Just remember the story that Jesus told about the power of one sower. Remember when he talked about the sower casting out the seed and it fell in different soils, but when it finally reached the good soil, remember what he said about it? He said it brings all kind of increase, some 30, some 60, some 100-fold, just from one sower. And what that teaches me is that I've got to make sure that I never doubt God's ability to do his work through even just one person. It's like what God said throughout Isaiah in Isaiah 55. He said, "My word will not return to me void without accomplishing what I purpose, or what I want it to accomplish." So here's just kind of bringing all of this to a close and tying it all together. If we're going to be influential people, then it starts by rejoicing and remembering what God's done for us, and then appreciating that enough to go out and to get to work. I mean, we talked about all of those things, the things that sowing might represent. It might represent trying to build relationships, or trying to raise kids, or trying to get rid of sin in our own lives. Those are tearful processes, right? I mean, it's never comfortable trying to rip out old habits that we've built that have become ingrained and getting rid of sin in our lives. It's never comfortable talking to people about the gospel when we're afraid that they're going to turn us down. But the promise is there. Now, let me just make one other point in the last few minutes here. Turn over to Galatians chapter 6, and I want to look at one other thing. Sometimes we talk about the hardest thing being that we feel like, what difference can one person make? That may not be our problem. Maybe what's discouraging us is that we feel like we keep sowing and sowing and sowing, and we just never see any results. Well, notice what Paul says about this in Galatians chapter 6, verses 7 through 9. He tells the Galatians, "Do not be deceived. God is not mocked. For whatever a man sows, he will also reap. Because the one who sows to his flesh will reap corruption from the flesh, but the one who sows to the Spirit will reap eternal life from the Spirit. So we must not get tired of doing good, for we will reap at the proper time if we don't give up." We have to remember that sowing in our lives is a process, and whether we're talking about trying to reach the lost, or whether we're talking about trying to raise kids, or trying to get rid of sin in our lives, we have to remember that it's a process. And sometimes, if my frustration is that I just don't see results, what does Paul say? He says, don't give up. You'll reap in due time. The hard thing is that he never tells us when the due time is. But the promise is there. Now, I think the question that brings to our minds, or it should challenge us with, is, okay, well where do I sow? I mean, maybe you're the kind of person you care about the lost and you want to reach him, but you've been spending your time more with, like, worldly pursuits. And I don't even mean, like, necessarily sinful things. I just mean, like, all of your time and all of your energy goes to things of this world. Now, make no mistake about it, you'll reap something from that. Good things may come from that, but here's Paul's point. Those things will only be temporary, and that's all they'll ever be. There's never anything in that that's going to be any more lasting than just the end of this life. And so the encouragement for us is, I've got to ask myself, okay, where am I sowing? Where am I spending my time, and what am I putting my energy into? If I want to influence people for the Lord, then it's got to be spiritual things, as he says. If we sow to the Spirit, we'll reap of the Spirit everlasting life. We just got a couple more minutes. I want to close with this thought. You go back to the beginning of this psalm, and remember that it's called a psalm of ascents, and your Bible may have different words for that, a song of degrees or a song of the pilgrims. What these were the songs or the psalms that the Israelites or the Jews would sing as they walked up to Jerusalem to go and worship at the temple. During the festivals during the year that they would all go to and they would all attend, they'd all flock into Jerusalem. Remember, Jerusalem was kind of a high place. It was to get there from anywhere, you'd have to go up into the city. And that's why these were called songs of ascent or songs of degrees. You sang them as you got higher and higher up into the city or closer to the city. Think about if you were a Jew and you were going on your way to the temple, for example, to worship. Why would this be a song that you would sing? What would this do for you? If you're on your way to worship and you're singing a song about what God's done for us and how he's delivered us, and the fact that there are still others that are in need of his deliverance, you think about how that's going to affect your worship. How it's going to put you in the mindset of being grateful to God and then appealing to him for those who are still lost. Keep that in mind this morning. Here in a minute, we're going to break for just a few minutes. But after we do that, we're going to come back and we're going to sing some songs. And we're going to pray together. And we're going to remember Jesus' sacrifice and take communion together. Think about this song. And use it to prepare your hearts just as they prepared as they went to the temple to worship. Think about what God's done for you and the captivity that he led you out of. And then think about the people in your life that are important to you that are still back in Babylon. And look at God's promises. We sow and we do the work, even when it's hard. And at the end of that comes the harvest of joyful shouting. I hope this has been helpful in giving you some things to think about. Thanks for your kind attention this morning. We'll take a break for a few minutes and get started here soon.